Okay, so I was gonna leave this thing that Lenina said when I asked her about like a lot of people who are gonna read the article would be white anti-racists and like what's our role in the movement and what she said, one of the things she said, I mean, it's part of a larger interview, but one of the things she said, she said for white people who have had some level of privilege, who are good writers or speakers, or who have had a good education, their role is to really be a trainer. And they can continue to write, because if you're teaching someone how to be a writer, but you're also writing yourself, that person feels like, I'm being taught by someone who really does this stuff and takes it seriously. You have to see if you can play a role in helping somebody who's afraid that what they say or how they'll say something won't be accepted, because historically it hasn't been.
Yeah. I thought that was
really
peaceful.
We're doing our Q&A.
Oh, okay.
It's a, does anyone have questions for Dan? They sat down. Why did they sit down?
Didn't care about the way.
Yeah, they have a question just in general of slam. Just, you guys talked a lot about having, coming from a lot of different places politically. Is there a way that what was your common ground and what, I mean, it sounds like it was beyond the organizing. And did you guys have study groups and, how did that all come together?
there was a lot of things that were in the mix. I mean, for one thing, like, we really liked each other, and that always helps. it's so tough to be an organization unless we don't like the other people in the organization. So I guess I think that was a thing. I think we had such a deep, abiding respect for what everyone brought to the mix. And it really was a really kind of cool mix. And I also think that, it was also because of the, one of the things that I don't want to lose track of is that just the question of gender within the organization. It was a mostly women organization, and it had such a deep impact upon how we did organize and how we cared for each other. And I think that was such a big thing in terms of like how we understood like the work that we did. There was a level in which that there was allowance of a level of intimacy that oftentimes we were kind of missing from our organizations that kind of brought it to the forefront. And I also think that it was also because we kind of understood history in a certain way. Like you mentioned study, and I just remember just being so excited about how many different ideologies there were, and always wanted to learn. So I never really kind of boxed myself in, or no one really wanted to box themselves in to a particular ideology. And that's a question of going beyond a certain one-dimensionality to a three-dimensionality. So it's kind of like, back in the day, actors used to speak like 3 or 4 languages. Just because to understand the world, not everything was in English with the internet. So it was kind of like the same thing. It was kind of like, okay, I'm talking to a Trotskyist, and it took me a long time to say Trotskyist. It took me quite the time,
How nice of you.
Huh?
How nice of you.
Exactly. But to talk to a Trotskyist and to understand where that person was coming from, and then read C.L.R. James, or then read the History of the Russian Revolution, or then Susie mentions like Blackout Books. One of the first times I actually encountered a history of my first lecture on revolutionary nationalism was at Blackout Books with Robert Williams. Yeah, Matt. That's another story. Matt Kress, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's true, yeah. So there's all sorts of different things are happening.
Like they knew, like, oh, he's white, wait a minute.
Exactly. It was interesting.
Like Long Island and Jewish White.
Yeah.
He was definitely with the John Hal Griffin of the, you know, the movement. If you remember that book, Black Like Me. But, and I hope he edited that part.
That's the part that's
going to
make it on
the TV. Exactly. But, I don't know. I don't want to take too much time on the question, but that was, for me, that was a part of the mix that was kind of created. And it was really exciting. You know, also, like, you know, it was also very funny, too, because, like, the music we listened to really was interesting, too, at the time. You know, I don't mean to be nostalgic about it, but there was this one album in particular called New Week and Soul.
Aww.
You know what I'm saying? That kind of, like, combined everything. It was, like, salsa, African American hip, R&B, disco music, and that was, and I every time I hear that sound, I think about like the mix that we always lived in, you know, like the certain things. But you know, I don't know if anyone else wants to take that question on.
Can I just add a little?
All right, please.
I just wanted to add that we also took a lot of time to check each other a lot. You know, we had, you know, we usually have a lot of intensive discussions. I know a lot of political organizations try to like separate personal from political, and that was one of the barriers that we really tried to erase, because we really saw the personal as political. You know, and that's something that we really take to heart even now. You know, so a lot of the people who really, you know, came through our doors, you know, hopefully, you know, they also continue to practice that, and they see, you know, the political as personal. We're always checking each other. We used to have, you know, long hours just kind of exercise our dysfunctions. You know, we live in a capitalist society. You know, it causes us to be schizophrenic. You know, and that's, you know, even if you're nominally sane. You know, but it really tries to destroy you on a daily level. It tries to get you to destroy other people on a daily level. So we really try to figure out how we can try to be human. You know, and that's a very important component of what we try to accomplish. You know, try to share with each other. So. Yeah.
But we had concrete audiences. It wasn't like, you know, we had arguments, and we had the little red study group that was kind of like, are we a cadre? No, we're a mass organization, you know. And to me, it was like, when I first joined SLAM, I joined it for open admissions. It was like, I don't know if they go over open admissions.
No, but
if their admission's open. So, I didn't know shit. Like, you know. Like, my brother was a conspiracy theorist, you know, he was just like, you know, he was in and out of jail, you know, he was a drug dealer, so it was, all I knew is that I hated the cops, so I joined, like, out of this just, like, I knew shit was messed up, you know, and through, like, being politicized, it was, like, it was just something really real for me. Like, I went to Chiapas shortly after 98, and I got arrested, or whatever, so I just kind of, like, knew it intimately, like, going into the prison system and being, like, are you serious? You know, like, Kazembe was, they were bringing him out with all fours, you know, and trying to beat him. And I remember, like, being like, this is it. Like, this is, like, what we see in our communities, and here we are. Like, it's not something, like, you gotta get schooled on, you know, it's just you feel it. And then, you know, I wanted to be part of something that was doing something. And I think at that point, I was, like, delving into, like, Buddhism and trying to be like, this is, you know, what is this? What's the meaning, you know? But then I realized that, like, even when we started teaching the high school students, I mean, like, we were reading The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, like, just doing the isms workshops, like, just really breaking it down, like, capitalism, like, homophobia, heterosexism, you know, like, white supremacy. It just becomes real basic. Like, these are structures, you know? And we're able to, like, throw that out there in a way that's not, like, overwhelming to people. Like, you know what I mean? Like, people don't want to be classified as this. People just want to know what's the deal. And I think that we tried to, like, put that out there. And when we, at least me, for when we started teaching high school students, when we took open admissions, was like, we're passing out flyers, and people were like, I don't give a shit. You know, like, I'm already in college. Why would I care about if I'm going to get into college? I'm already here, you know? And we're like, oh, they're going to take away remedial education. Like, the schools are, like, defunct. You know, people are graduating, you know, and they're still not getting into, like, graduating top of the class and still not getting into CUNY school. So then you start realizing, well, there's a system here. Like, they're trying to, like, do something here. They're trying to privatize this whole master plan. And then you start realizing the inner workings of it. So we were trying to give that to the college students, and they were like, give a shit. You know, like, we want our standards to be higher. But what does that mean, being having higher standards? You know, like, and we were having these discussions, and it was just like, it was really frustrating, you know, and that's when we started bringing it to the high school students, because they were like, well, you guys, you know, you might not be able to go to college. I mean, what do you think about that? Like, not being able to, like, really go to, like, these colleges and, you know, live at home, you have a job. Like, it's New York City. Like New Yorkers, like, native New Yorkers is different than, like, people that move to New York, yeah. You know, like, it's folks that, like, the fuck, like, I grew up with the projects, like, I'm gonna go to CUNY, right? Like, I'm gonna get, you know, I'm gonna get tuition, I'm gonna get my grants paid, you know, I'm gonna have a job, I got kids, you know, they were changing the whole workfare to welfare program, mm-hmm. So there was a lot of things kind of, like, giving us momentum. It wasn't just, like, you know, just, like, ideal philosophy. It was definitely something that we had to pinpoint and give it to high school. Once we gave it to high school students, I really felt like it started honing in on us, like, how good.
I just want to say one thing about, like, unifying ideas. I think there was a commitment to, which people have said a lot of different ways, but, like, human level, you know, so again, it's not so much, like, simple ideological affirmation, but it's a way of doing things. You know, and in terms of what actually makes a group hold together, sometimes if you can, you know, it's again, it's not trying to cut everyone else. But there was another thing that happened really early on, like in 95, in this initial movement that broke out, but then into 1996, when we actually formed SLAM, which was not working with the Democratic Party. And 1995, and this is very key, because I think if this had not happened, we would not have formed an organization, and it would not have been able to hold itself together as a distinct political project. So Giuliani's in power in New York. Yeah, he's a relatively liberal Republican governor, but he doesn't feel liberal to us, right? Like, too liberal for Georgia, but not for Brooklyn, right? That kind of politics. You guys get that here in Pennsylvania, too. But so suddenly, a lot of these liberal politicians are like, yeah, Giuliani's such a bastard, and they see that there's thousands of students mobilizing, and suddenly all these mayoral candidates who are long-standing, like Ruth Messenger, these are long-standing liberal figures, which are, and there's, you know, the Al Sharptons, who's like sort of a permanent protester, no justice, no peace, go home. But I mean, that's the strategy. Like, there's heat, these people show up, they raise their fists, there's a whole apparatus that works like this. It's part of how dissent gets contained in our society. You know, we have major labor leaders, like Dennis Rivera, right, who's SEIU 1199. And so all these figures start showing up to offer you advice and be your friend. And whatever constituency you're from, that's people who show up and talk to you, right? So if you're like a young black kid, it's the Brooklyn politician alderman showing up. If you're the white intellectual, it's the professor who wants you to understand what's really going. Like, everybody's suddenly, and it's all going back to how we all have to be concerned about the next mayoral race or the next gubernatorial race. And it's like, well, how about this? How about you guys go organize a rally and invite us to speak at your rally? Right, and then maybe we'll return the favor. And they're like, well, who do you think you are to speak to us like this? You know, they're suddenly like, why is you want half the stage to be all these politicians? And the movement as a whole, and again, not just one or two people, is like, we're tired of being manipulated by these political apparatuses that just do not respond to us. You know, the all these liberals, you talk all this shit, but like, you guys were in the state for 50 years. 50 years, and you're acting like we have no memory. And it's like, shit, most people don't. But it's so through that period, you know, I think that was one of the things where if we want to look for allies, it's like, let's do things like when we came to Philadelphia to work on the R2K protests. Let's look to this anti-globalization movement or, you know, the alternative, not to, you know, how we're going to make our way into this already existing, right? But we actually want to build a new political project, not just resistance, but a new political center based on people who are from the presidency. And that's a key, and that's the thing, it doesn't matter how you think you're doing that, if that's where you're putting your work in, and that's where you're building capacity, and you're also struggling to, in some ways, inoculate people to the bullshit and lies that these liberal politicians give us, I think that's part of what enables people's power to foster and develop. And without that political clarity about the nature, like, whose state this is, whatever we think about the state is an abstract, this state is ours, right? Like, and we're going to have to fight.
I saw a hand up here, and then you, and then there.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, like, how did y'all deal with racism in the movement, and also, like, for any of the queer people of color, or women of color, or trans people of color that might have been there, how, was the intersectionality of that, like, completely overlooked or, like, ignored, like, over my oppressions.
It's a lot of caucusing.
I mean, in terms of like the queerness and the intersectionality, I think it really kind of aided us that, like I said before, a lot of us came out of the closet as we're doing this political work. You know, I'm saying, so we were transformed as we're doing this political work, asking ourselves this question: if I'm at this protest, you know, saying about, like, you know, open admissions of police brutality or Mumia, why can't I talk about my sexuality? You know, saying, and be open about it. And how come I'm not tapping into that? You know, and then so it became this kind of spiral in which people began to kind of support each other in that, and really kind of developing a more of an analysis. You know, it kind of flourished a little bit after I left SLAM, which was like around 2000, and I was kind of regretful because I was like, what were you, all you great queers when I was in the fucking area? It's like, damn, you know, I had me enrolling and shit, and I was, you know, but it was like one of those things that kind of happened, but it kind of took itself, you know, in terms of long term. But in terms of like the racism thing, I mean, that was kind of a really kind of sticky issue within SLAM, because like it operated on a couple of different levels. One level I operated on was the level of this, you have a group of people of color, you know, articulating their voices and creating political movements, and at the same time challenging, you know, white normativity and heterosexism, right? But within that context as well, it gets even a little stickier, because then you're also dealing with this other question, which was oftentimes kind of raised, which was that New York City, how do I explain this? New York City is very, African-American politics within New York City is very much informed by the Caribbean and majority consciousness. So if you look at New York City national formations, it's Garveyite. You know what I'm saying? So within SLAM, there was this other tension between black, brown.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And there was this consistent, you know, trying to meld, you know, the different traditions that were happening. You know what I'm saying? And trying to go beyond a constituency fight. Right? And I think that for myself, and I don't know. I think a lot of people dealt with it really well, you know, in terms of that. But it was very clear in terms of like consistent work and conversation and caucusing, you know, we were able to smoke it out. But it was painful at times. It was really personally painful. There was a lot of stuff that we went through that was like really kind of like that ripped us apart in so many different ways because of that. I don't know if anyone else wants to kind of jump in on that question.
or should we take the hand up? Should we take your hand?
Yeah. I just want to say, I think that we overlooked the fact that we have certain resources that were like institutionalized. Like we have BLPR, which is Black Political Studies, that they transform, which was my major, your major, minor, you know. Everybody was taking BLPR, so we had like teachers that were like political prisoners that were actually teaching us, you know. So like, Kenyani from Kenya, you know, like, we're like, wow, you know, so these people were like, you know, you got to do something, you know. These are like the elders who actually done real work and have sacrificed parts of their lives for it. So I think that because it was like African Latino Studies or BLPR, Black Puerto Rican Studies, and it being birthed in the CUNY, I mean, that's really special. Like, I think about it now, I'm like, wow, that was really special. Because people fought for it in the 60s, I don't know if people are like, aware of the history behind it, but in 69, right? And they established that it wasn't like, you go, I think we should have a BLPR. And there was a ethnic and pluralism diversity requirement within the college and all CUNY system. So we really had like this, we had a huge resource of people like,
who were like in the Puerto Rican nationalist movement, who were really like African nationalists, like, you know, like this is how we heal ourselves, you know, people straight from Africa or people who were African American or, you know, black, you know, or with a capital B, you know, and explain to us this is the institution of racism. This is how it spreads out. This is where it works. This is what a ghetto is. You know what I'm saying? These are the liquor stores, you know, and just really like, here it is. Here it is. And this is why the demographics. And then we have, you know, Professor Rodriguez. So that's like, because I took BLPR with Concentration in Black Studies. But then we have Professor Rodriguez, who is like, this is the IMF. And this is the political economy, you know, and so, you know, we had that. And so we had people, we were able to mobilize, like, within that, a group of people who were like, oh, we know this stuff, you know, now what? You know what I mean? So I just feel like that's something that I guess we kind of overlooked, like, but Hunter College was huge in the BLPR department.
I'm so glad you mentioned that up, because it really kind of reconstructed our imagination in terms of what was in the past and how we look in the future. In terms of opening up that space.
Right, we were Sean Palante.
He was Sean Palante,
like,
yeah.
And
reminding us also that, you know, like people like Arturo Schomburg, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying, who was the Puerto Rican founder of the Schomburg Library for Black Studies. You know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. that interconnection that happened between Puerto Rican and Black communities, you know what I'm saying, that was always in that existence. You know, so that was like, yeah.
Yeah,
that,
which I mean, feel like here there's like more of a chasm. I feel like over there there's like, even though, you know, Latino, Afro, Latino, like, if there's people that are really like well-versed in like, you know, that.
Right.
I just want to say, I think it's important to say that like there was a level of discomfort, you know, and I think that people grow from that. Like, we didn't feel like, oh, we love each other so much and we feel so comfortable here and this is my space. I think a lot of us felt like we had our own space. Like, I was very much into, you know, the Puerto Rican thing, the Latina thing, you know, and continues in my life to be my space. Like, that's where I feel, you know, I like being around other Latinas who are, you know, into poetry and politics and whatever else. Like, that's, I feel comfortable there. But I joined this space because of my politics, because of my need to want to change the world. I mean, you know, and I think all of us kind of, We had a little bit of that, like, whether we felt like, I mean, like, John is involved in all types of stuff with comic books and, like, and art, you know, and he's coming from that. He feels comfortable in that world and comfortable with artists, but he's also seeing how that connects to this space, and we're all sort of struggling, and it goes back to, like, what Jed said about just kind of working it out as we're working it out, you know, But we're not. But even if you look at us, like, each one of us sort of comes from a different type of affinity or background. We're not sort of the same. We don't have the same look. We don't have the same way of identifying. I think that that's really what helped to create growth for us, and something very dynamic. And I think that that's what
we're like free Palestine, right? Free Vieques, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, Suzanne is in here, but like Suzanne and Suhair Hamad are very engaged in like Palestinian liberation politics.
And
but
Black
we're also
studies.
Very engaged in this because they could see the connection that this is more about like what's possible, you know, this sort of more international multi-generational, multi-ethnic grouping that can transform society. Mm-hmm. You know?
And I also think that we will also fly. You know what I'm saying? I'm sure to say that because I'm serious. You know what I'm saying? No. We really were the squad. You know what I'm saying?
We had a campaign like our last year. When we were transforming, like transitioning to like the younger folks, we had this campaign, like we're gonna call it the Crazy Sexy Cool. And the whole thing was like, you know, because we had stopped the high school organizing program. It was like, that's it. 3 years, you know, we're all drained, some people were leaving. Remember, Grass?
You're like, you gotta take it over.
I was like, not me, I'm not. That won't be me. I mean, I'm glad I knew my limitations at the time, because I'm not even thrown into anything. But, you know, we were doing like prison abolition work, MIA work, you know, we were all like, but we were like, how do we bring this in a place where we, because it started feeling like we were becoming like this like elitist group of like people were like, oh, if you join SLAM, then you gotta be like this, you know, and it was just starting to be like,
you know, like, unattainable. Like, people were like, you're dealing with political folks. And so we wanted to be like, no, we're real folks with real issues, and we know you got real issues. So we brought it to, like, we did, like, yoga, we did sex workshops, you know, by one of our transgender folks. We did, we did Queens of Hip Hop, you know. We just did, like, it was called Slam Thursday, so we did it every Thursday. We did something where we were, like, just kind of, like, I think we did, like, our herbalist workshop, just stuff that we were, like, you know, this is, like, a transformative thing, like, in every aspect of our lives. And I think that that was really cool because we brought a lot of different folks in from there, too.
I want to say that there was white racism in the group, and we kept fucking up. Like, we would fuck up, and then we would fuck up again, and, it was very, there's a child in the room, but he's very little. I'm just like, the thing is that people did have to call us out, and we have things. So I just want to say that it's true, and we did think that we also thought that we were the good white people, which gave us a license to lecture other white people. So I wanted to take the next hand, but I thought that I would be amiss if, and I can go into detail if people want to ask me later, but I want that comment, and then Darryl.
I guess, like, two things. First, really quickly, to, like, all the people of color, like, that were involved with Slam that just shared, I would really like to invite, and any radical people of color in this room, like, this summer we're having a Northeast Anti-Authoritarian Autonomous People of Color Conference, and the younger generation of APOC is really trying to build a movement. We don't have one in the U.S., not, like, or at least not one that's accessible to a lot of us, and... we want to learn from all radical people of color. So afterwards, if you want to talk to, like, me or, like, Mariana or Daryl, who's in the back, like, all of us are part of the APOC Philly Collective. It's going to be here in Philly. But second, I guess I just want to ask, like, maybe directed again towards the folks of color that shared, like, maybe, like, coming out of, like, SLAM and, like, being, like, a little bit older generation than, like, the new SDS with a lot of failures that it had. I just wonder, like, specifically, like, there's all kinds of failures that it had, but on the fact of, like, trying to have a coalition of socialists and communists and anarchists and liberals, like, I feel like that was a... I feel like it was, like, a very... It didn't work as one of many failures that the new SDS has and will have. And I'm just wondering, like, what was the difference, like, just 10 years ago that, like, I felt like someone had shared that, like, even with Maoists and socialists and anarchists, like, it still, like, seemed to, like, people could still come together, but I feel like the new SDS doesn't have that. I'm just wondering, like, from an outsider perspective, because I have my own opinions, but I was an SDS, like.
Where are you guys operating from? Like, an institution? Like, where is the base?
It's kind of all over the place. Like, there's, like, the, like, community college, there's the, like, white, rich, like, private colleges, there's high schools, I'm not even a student, like, wasn't a student, like, it was all over the place, in addition to, like, mainly white, dominated by men, like, kind of aspect.
What?
Wow. We had Hunter, which was mostly women. And then we had City College, which was mostly men, Filipino men. We had Grasshopper, who hopped around. We had Brooklyn College. So they were all very different, right? And so the Hunter, I felt like, was a base, you know? And I feel like you need a base, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you want, like, a people, I mean, I don't know the answers, but I'm just, like, trying to tell you, like, Hunter was a base.
You know, I mean, let me say one thing that I find really interesting. Is that, it seemed to me that and maybe I'm wrong, but the two takeovers that happened in New York City, in the New School at NYU, that came out of the current student movement, were really interesting to me because they were about governance in a deep sense of who runs the universities. and who controls universities. And I think that one of the things is that that becomes something of a fault line in terms of contemporary society, in terms of how we understand the role of education in our contemporary system. You know, so for me, one thing looking at it is how do we develop that analysis of where these particular, where we at in terms of education today? You know, and where we're at in terms of the role of education in, you know, in terms of overall. From my very like limited sociological work, I look at this as a period of time of where really there's a retrenchment in terms of the working class, and there's a retrenchment in terms of people's choice in terms of how they engage their labor. So we're creating, so the education system is creating a labor force that's really more flexible and precarious. So people don't stay at jobs at the same time in 2 or 3 years, you know, and then they're out, and they don't have any benefits. So I mean, I think that's part of like thinking through some of that, and now analytical work is important as well. But I also think that, you know, going back to kind of a utopian thing, like, let's ask ourselves a question. What would it look like if we're actually engaging in a process of an end of ideology? You know what I'm saying? Can we actually deal with that and imagine that for a second? Because, you know, something that my friend told me the other day, she was like, Obama is really about civil rights. You know, he was like, black people get civil rights, gay folks might just get marriage. You know, and there's a lot of things that happen, but it always goes back to what Toni Morrison said a little bit. It was like, when she said, what does it mean to be licensed but not liberated? What does it mean to be licensed but not free? And I think that liberation needs to be at the center of our agenda, you know, in terms of our understanding of the current movement. And liberation needs to be the center of our work. So how does that really transform our understanding of ideology and how we look at the world? I mean, I think that's a courageous question to ask.
I can also add, you know, like, I mean, this is just a suggestion. I mean, we're definitely sharing our story, and it might be something, you know, that's not applicable in this situation. I mean, I just want to say that our experience is a product of a particular moment in time, and so that's past. So, you know, we're just sharing those lessons because it might have some relevance. But one of the things that we're always trying to find, and this might be helpful, is to find a basis of unity. You know, I mean, trying to find at least some common denominator that can, you know, pull people together, so that it's not about, you know, a sectarian, just ideology. And the other thing is a common project, you know, might be something that can actually pull people together to build unity. Sometimes, you know, we don't start off with unity. We may actually, you know, it's unity and struggle. And without that struggle, there might not be any, you know, unity. In New York, I ended up joining this new formation called the Block Movement, and we do what's called a People's Transportation Program. Basically, we just like hit up train stations and we swipe people in for free because we have metro cards, right? And then we get a monthly cash. So we, like in about 4 months, we set up in, we pulled some of the college kids who were coming out of school, and we had maybe like 3 stations that we do about once a month. So I'm just saying, like, this is something new. I mean, this is not SLAM, but it's a new formation based on unity and practice. And I'm really excited about this because it's got a lot of new young blood, and it reminds me a little bit of, you know, SLAM, you know, like the old days and stuff. But it's something totally new, you know, and it's definitely not campus-based, you know, because we're doing this in neighborhoods, in the train stations. So this is a totally new kind of development. And maybe it might, there's something that you guys might be able to work on that can actually help build unity. That's what I don't know if that helps.
So there are a bunch of hands up in the back corner and then there.
what were some, yeah, I think you've mentioned a couple of them. I'm wondering specifically what were some of the major frustrations for SLAM, what frustrations were you able to deal with boom gone? What frustrations came back? It became more of a matter of coping.
Yeah, I mean, just frustrations as internal tensions are different things. And one thing I would say is I think in through the whole late 90s period, you know, from there, like when you came to the Bush administration, there had been, I think we experienced a grassroots movement. And so maybe that's the SDS question that you were asking. You know, like one thing is like SDS doesn't have thousand students demanding a particular style of political activism. Oh, wow. Right, so what the social base of SDS seems to be activism. Right, and it's not a this is who's coming together and engaging in the struggle. This was a situation where there was a mass movement that was generated largely from young working class, people of color movements in New York City, and young activists who were tired of dealing with organizations who were from prior, like from New Left, 68 era generations, not giving up their space. So these things came together. At the same time, there was a whole series of similar movements that broke out in California around various youth initiatives, Prop 21, affirmative action fights in the Cal system. And so one thing that was really hard was it felt like there were these two generating areas of large organic left-wing activism, and that the rest of the country keep it in the left was done. Right, so part of the frustration was is that even though we could see this real good work, it was not translating out into the other communities. Like we didn't have any internet presence at all. We had like a single website. We didn't own computers. Right, and then we go to the private
after
school.
The
and everybody's
like,
online.
We did after it was over. Then we had a website.
So it's like it really felt like there was these like.
We're gone.
It's like the ghetto where things are really happening. It's like, oh, we're out here in the middle of nowhere. Well, all the shit's actually happening. And that's very frustrating because you can't communicate an experience that someone else hasn't actually gone through. And it's like, well, that's just your rap. And it's like, okay. So we didn't win.
This had a lot of urgency issues. Oh, sorry. I'm still thinking about your question. Urgency, like tuition, how do you keep the issues open? We were running from the student government. I think it's the same old stuff that doesn't ever go away, you know? Like the white guys talking too much in the meeting, and like we gotta struggle around that. And it's like we had to struggle around people that were very nationalist, you know, and felt like they didn't want to have any, you know, like their primary thing was like, you know, like black people have to be at the center or something like that. And so it was just like, well, that's important, but you know, we also want to change like the social relations in the society, you know, the economic relations. Like, how do we bridge that with like? You wanted to support the Million Man March or that kind of thing. You know, like we used to have a lot of tensions between all of that, all of our political tendencies that we had in the organization. We had to bridge all of that, you know. And it wasn't easy, but we somehow managed to do it. Yeah.
There'd be times where we'd be like, we're not feeling that, but we have to go because the group said we're gonna, you know, like the.
Or people
the arts,
that would come
RNC,
in out of anywhere.
That
this is all
it.
Crap, and what we really need is a, you know, like the workers' strike or whatever, you know, it's like, you know, and people would get into fist fights, you know, I mean, or almost. It was, you know, so there was a lot, but I think it was a lot about the politics. But because we had so many people engaged, there was a lot, so many people engaged. It was like we would work through it, you know.
I was gonna say like. Towards the end, when I became a project director, I started doing this like service project where we were going to this families in the Bronx. I don't remember what it's called, Fury or whatever. But anyway, it's in the Bronx, and we were doing this whole like
try to get the clubs involved because they're very like, we're just a club and we just dance on Wednesdays. You know what I mean? Or something like that. Like, they just didn't do anything really. You know, well, maybe we can like tap into them. And, you know, because they were kind of passionate about certain things, but it was just like all cultural. And so we were like, well, maybe we can just kind of, you know, bring that in. And so we did this kind of like hand drive and stuff like that. And then like, I remember like another member of the organization who was highly respected, who I highly respected, was like, brought somebody else, like a woman of color, to come confront me. Like, so what are we, like, creating a service organization now? You know, and I was just like, what the fuck? You know, like, what? Like, I'm trying to do something different. Like, support me, you know what I mean? I'm not, this is not a service organization, but it was like these, like, tensions here and there. And, like, I had to do, you know, like, you gotta grow up and faith, you know, you can't just be like, fuck this, we're gonna do this, you know, you gotta be like, okay, so what is your problem with this, and have, like, real discussions about, like, this is why I think this is, you know, like, don't underestimate the power of these things, you know what I mean? I don't know if that's helpful, but I just remember that, like, really, like, start, like...
Okay. I'm gonna try to say something to you. I think, one of the, things not just the folks who speak to speak, but also the crowd at large, what do y'all consider to be the end game or producing results? What do you consider to be how do you think you probably would define it? Because I think it was talking we have talked about our activism along the lines of educating. Some of us are educated to the point where we can actually start applying and coming back to the pound of flesh, so to speak. And the reason why I say that is because the kind of activism I'm involved in, you have to go back to the pound of flesh. And I think one is also something, it's always good to do to think along those lines, because It will attract, nothing attracts the public more to what it is you're doing than something a little bit tangible. And I don't necessarily mean you're pushing something to the point of victory. It's also something as simple as putting on a block party. Your organization just put a block party on. Or Hoover Movement here in Philadelphia. Every month during the summer months, they have their little flea market over in Clark Park just down the road from here. I mean, I think if people see that you're putting something into the community or into society in general, they're going to be a little bit more receptive. And I want to know what would be something that you think that you can be involved with that can see that happen. I mean, I can give you an example of one of the things that is going on right now here in Philly. Tomorrow, hopefully not, there's going to be a concert over at the bar. There's a group called One Life Crew that's playing. Or hopefully it got canceled. They probably moved it. They probably just simply lied. Because the scuttlebutt that we've been getting is that One Life Group is playing in Cleveland right now. They're racist, sexist, homophobic. They're just really sick. I've been active against them for a long time.
Kid Rock?
No. One Life Group. No, this is worse. Kid Rock never threatened to break my room. So we got them bounced out of the First Unitarian Church. We got them bounced out of the First Unitarian Church, but there's a possibility that they could be playing the Barbary, which is down in it's a ways from here, so.